Hello, this is your Polycast for Wednesday, April 16th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, first quarter fundraising reports, new research shows people of color breathe more polluted air, and Minneapolis considers a ban on foam food containers. Governor Mark Dayton says lawmakers don't need to address controversial tax breaks for the 2018 Super Bowl. Tim Nelson reports.
The NFL is expected to announce its choice to host the Super Bowl on May 20th. If Minnesota wins its bid, the championship would be played in the new stadium being built in downtown Minneapolis. Dayton says a letter to the NFL pledges state support in the form of tax breaks.
You know, the major tax concession is the foregoing of the sales tax on the sale of tickets. And that was passed for the 1992 Super Bowl, and it was not rescinded. So that's ongoing until somebody changes it. So that's about $9 million of tax incentives that have already there on the table if things remain as they are.
New Orleans and Indianapolis are also in the running to host the 2018 Super Bowl. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Best Buy's CEO says he's optimistic Congress will finally make online retailers collect state sales taxes this year. Martin Moylan reports.
Best Buy has long pushed for federal legislation requiring online retailers to charge the taxes that bricks-and-mortar retailers have to collect from customers. CEO Hubert Joly says his company always adds applicable sales taxes to online purchases, but Joly objects that rivals such as Amazon.com can skip the taxes.
If you buy from an out-of-state seller like Amazon, today Amazon is not collecting the sales tax. Right, so that's a 8 to 10% advantage that they have.
Joly called on the U.S. Senate to join the House in passing a bill mandating sales tax collections. States lose billions of dollars a year in uncollected sales taxes on online and catalog purchases. Minnesota misses out on an estimated $400 million annually. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
This week, state and federal candidates and political groups are reporting how much money they raised during the first 3 months of the year. And here to tell us what the state picture looks like is reporter Catherine Richard. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Mike.
Well, let's start with the race for governor. Mark Dayton is the DFL incumbent. How did he do in the first quarter?
Well, he raised about $200,000, but he has over $700,000 in the bank. So he's doing pretty well so far compared to his competitors.
And what about his competitors? There are five Republicans really actively campaigning for the privilege, I guess, of running against him in the fall.
Right.
Who's raising the most?
Well, Scott Honor, once again, raised the most. He raised $250,000 in the first quarter. But what I always look at is how much these candidates actually have in the bank. Mm-hmm. And Scott Honor actually doesn't have much in the bank at all. He only has about $63,000. So it seems like he's sort of spending money to raise money right now. In fact, Jeff Johnson, who raised the least, $32,000 in the first quarter, actually has the most in the bank right now. He has over $140,000.
And how much does Mark Dayton have in the bank?
He has $733,000 in the bank.
And if I'm not mistaken, that's more than all the Republicans combined have on hand.
Yeah. You know, and of course, the one thing to keep in mind is that there are five candidates who are trying to run against him. So donors right now are dispersing their money. The thought is that eventually it'll come together, whereas there's only Dayton on the left. So all the money is sort of going to him.
And I guess it's always easier for an incumbent to raise money.
Exactly.
Okay. What about the House, because the state House is on the ballot, too. The governor isn't the only one up for re-election.
Right. So what I looked at yesterday was how much both the DFL and the Republican sides had raised. And what I mean by that is, you know, the DFL party, but then also the House and Senate caucuses and the GOP party in their House and Senate caucuses. And again, the DFL is in the lead. They raised $1.4 million altogether. So the DFL and the two House and Senate caucus fundraising arms.
Okay.
And they have $1.5 million in the bank. So they are doing pretty well at this point. Now, on the GOP side, they raised a total of $527,000, and they have $908,000 in the bank.
Okay. So is it fair to say, then, that the Democrats have a fundraising advantage, at least at this point?
Absolutely, yeah.
And what does that mean, do you suppose?
Well, I think it means that, first of all, they're in the majority. So, you know, the donors are very much so behind them as the majority party. They have a lot of races they have to care about. They have the governor's race. They have Al Franken, who's also running for office this year. And then they have to keep 7 seats in the House. So they have to play up and down the ballot. Now, on the GOP side, I think there's still a question of where the donors are going to sort of put their money. Do they care more about taking the House? Do they care more about the Senate? Do they care more about the governor's race? We just don't know yet, again, because there are so many candidates and things are sort of scattered across the board.
And at least the state Republican Party started with sort of a hamstrung, right? I mean, they had that big debt.
Right. They're still digging themselves out of debt that was accumulated under former Chairman Tony Sutton. And that was several years ago now. Right now, they still have over $500,000 in debt that they're working on. And a lot of that is from Sutton's tenure. So it's not new debt. It's really old debt at this point.
All right. Catherine Richard, watching the fundraising. Thanks a lot.
No problem.
People of color tend to live in neighborhoods that have higher levels of a common pollutant than white people. University of Minnesota researchers estimate 7,000 heart disease deaths could be prevented each year among people of color if they breathed the same lower nitrogen dioxide levels that white people breathe. Lorna Benson reports.
U of M researchers used U.S. Census data to compare where people live with newly published satellite and land use information that estimate nitrogen dioxide concentrations around the country. Lead author of the study, Julian Marshall, says he was shocked to find such a large disparity in the amount of exposure to the gas among whites and non-whites. In most areas, lower-income people of color were more exposed to nitrogen dioxide than higher-income whites.
As you get to higher income, the exposures go down, but there's still a gap between whites and non-whites.
That means income didn't matter as much as race in explaining the differences in exposure to nitrogen dioxide. The study identified 15 states that had the largest exposure gaps between whites and non-whites. Marshall says Minnesota was ranked 15th.
Even in a relatively clean air city and a clean air state, we still have these relatively large disparities. That's an important finding. That's not something I expected.
Although the study was not designed to explain why there are such significant racial gaps in exposure to nitrogen dioxide, its findings do not surprise Minnesota Commissioner of Health, Ed Ellinger. He says people of color tend to be more exposed to many environmental pollutants.
In this case, they live closer to highways. They live closer to places where transportation is much denser. And oftentimes live closer to places where they have pollution being generated from garbage burners or power plants.
Studies show that vehicle emissions are highest in the immediate vicinity of a busy freeway, major roadway, or downtown area. Nitrogen dioxide levels disperse as you move away from the roadway. But the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's Cassie McMahon says it takes about a quarter of a mile before the levels drop enough to blend into the background with other pollutants.
We know that very close to those areas is where concentrations are going to be highest. And if you happen to live near a roadway, you're likely going to be exposed to higher concentrations of nitrogen dioxide.
In 2013, the MPCA started monitoring nitrogen dioxide at the intersection of Interstate 94 and Interstate 35W in downtown Minneapolis to obtain a clearer picture of how the pollutant might be affecting people who live near the roadways. McMahon says so far levels of the gas have not exceeded U.S. EPA standards, but she says nitrogen dioxide readings are higher at the freeway monitoring station than they are at 3 other community monitoring stations, 2 of which are near a refinery complex. At the direction of state lawmakers, the health department is also studying air quality. A report to the legislature is due later this year. Health Commissioner Ellinger says he thinks the U of M report will help make the case that Minnesota should do more to reduce vehicle emissions by investing more in transit.
You know, if we have cars that are creating pollution, is it fair that pollution is really disproportionately affecting populations of color? And I think as a state, we say, no, that's not fair, and really we need to do something about it.
Ellinger says the study's assertion that 7,000 people of color could be saved annually in the U.S. if everyone breathed the same lower nitrogen dioxide levels is a wake-up call for Minnesota and the nation. But while U of M researchers acknowledge their calculation may seem unusually high, they suspect they're underestimating deaths because they did not account for the higher underlying rates of heart disease in some populations of color. Lorna Benson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The city of Minneapolis is considering a ban on styrofoam cups and takeout containers because they're hard to recycle. More than 100 cities and towns around the country have passed similar laws, but the industry that makes the foam is fighting back. Curtis Gilbert has the story.
Hi, I'd like some brown rice.
At least once a week, first-term Minneapolis City Council member Andrew Johnson gets his lunch at Spicy Touch Indian Grill in the city's downtown skyline.
Let's go with the chicken tiki masala.
He loves the grub.
Delicious food.
But hates what lands in the garbage can.
So usually when I come in here, when it's really busy during lunch hours, we'll actually see a little tower of styrofoam containers coming out of the trash bin because you just can't really fit that many in there.
That tower would be illegal under an ordinance Andrew is proposing. He wants to ban restaurants from selling food in containers made of what's technically called expanded polystyrene. Most people refer to it by the brand name styrofoam, and it's one of the few types of plastic Minneapolis doesn't recycle. The plastic in the foam actually is recyclable. The problem is there's not much plastic there. Only about 5% of a foam cup is polystyrene. The rest is just empty space. Minneapolis recycling manager Kelly Kish says that makes transporting it to market economically unattractive.
You are technically shipping air. With how expensive shipping is, that's not something that most companies want to spend their money on.
There is a way around that problem. It costs anywhere from $20,000 up to $100,000, and it's called a densifier.
This powerful machine can reduce 8,000 foam cups into one 15-inch by 15-inch 40-pound cylinder.
This promotional video comes from the Dart Container Company, the country's number one manufacturer of foam cups. It's led the opposition to proposed bans in other cities. Michael Westerfield directs the company's recycling program. He argues bans, like the one Minneapolis is considering, don't solve the problem.
If the foam cup and the takeout container is banned, most of the foam is still out there. When people buy new TVs, they'll still get it in that foam packaging. That's not banned. When they buy their meat, the meat tray is exempted, so they'll still get their meat tray. When they buy their ice chest, all that material is still there. But if they recycle, they can capture all of that material.
Nationwide, only a few dozen cities recycle styrofoam. In addition to the cost of equipment, there are logistical hurdles. Most potential buyers of used foam want the material squeaky clean. That's hard to achieve in a single-sort recycling program like the one Minneapolis uses. When newspaper and beer bottles get mixed with the plastic, things get messy. Food containers account for less than half of the 2.6 billion pounds of styrofoam consumed in the United States each year. Westerfield also points out that it's only a tiny percentage of the country's overall garbage output. A study last year from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency found about 1% of the state's trash was polystyrene, which is used in construction, packaging, even CD cases. The proposed Minneapolis ban only targets restaurants and would go into effect January 1st. The Minnesota Restaurant Association says it could live with a ban, but Executive Vice President Dan McElroy says his members would like more time to find an alternative that works as well.
Polystyrene has the advantage of not having your food stick to it, being reasonable in cost, readily available, something customers are accustomed to. But there are options.
Compostable takeout containers cost more than twice as much as foam ones, but their prices may come down as more cities pass bans like the one Minneapolis is considering. New York City is scheduled to implement a ban in July of 2015, but under its ordinance, the ban on styrofoam takeout containers would take effect only if the city determines recycling won't work. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And that's your Polycast for this Wednesday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.